Highbridge, Division of Recorded Books, presents Don't Turn Around by Harry Dolan. Read by George Newbern. 1. Later on, when the police questioned her, Katie Summerlin would say she went out to look at the full moon. Her father was teaching at Seagate College that year in a small town in upstate New York called Alexander. They lived in a rented farmhouse, and Katie's bedroom was tucked away in a corner of the ground floor. It had a tall casement window on the south wall with 16 panes of old glass. Katie woke in the night to the moon shining through, the shape of it wavy in the glass. She sat up. It was warm in the room. The alarm clock read 1:06. She drank from a bottle of water at her bedside. She didn't feel tired. She had snuck out once before, a few weeks earlier, on the night of her 11th birthday. Because you should be daring on your birthday. That time she didn't go far. Into the backyard to gaze up at the stars. Lots of them, out in the country. Now she crossed the room, smooth boards beneath her bare feet. She worked the latch of the casement window and swung it open. The hinges were quiet. Cooler out there. She moved her desk chair over and stepped onto the seat, then onto the sill, and then she was out, landing soft on the grass, knees bent. For a moment she listened and didn't move. Her parents' bedroom was on the second floor. Her mother was out of town, but her father would be sleeping up there. Katie stood and looked up at their bedroom window. She waited for it to open, for her father to call down. Nothing happened. She walked to the middle of the yard. It had rained in the evening, and the grass was still damp. She waded through it, farther on, through a scattering of dandelions, flecks of yellow in the moonlight. At the edge of the yard stood a trellis arch. Katie passed under it. There were flagstones in the grass. They made a path that led down to a stream. She followed them. Nighttime sounds surrounded her. She hadn't noticed them before. Far-off crickets. Something scurrying in the brush on her left. The stream should be coming up on her right. The flagstones ran out, and she was walking through grass again. It was rougher here, and longer. Maybe she should have worn shoes. When she came to the stream, she stopped to look at the sky. She found a bright star that she thought was Arcturus, then Ursa Major, the Big Dipper. She turned to look back, thought about how far she'd come. She couldn't see the house from here. She listened to the murmur of the stream. The water was clear. Katie could make out rounded stones at the bottom. Might as well go a little farther, she thought. She was daring, after all. She walked along parallel to the stream. Away on her left were the silhouettes of trees, and somewhere beyond them a road. The crickets chirped. The water flowed. She didn't stop or turn back. A breeze brushed cool through her hair. A dark shape loomed up ahead, a tall oak tree with a great spreading canopy. The wind stirred its leaves in slow motion. There was something else, a patch of white on the ground. White and gray, vague shapes. They came into focus as she drew closer. Someone was sleeping in the grass, a girl. Older than Katie, maybe a student from the college. She wore a white blouse with white buttons and long sleeves, a gray skirt. She lay on her back with her head tipped toward her left shoulder, and strands of her long dark hair fell across her face, obscuring her eyes. Her arms were spread straight out on either side. It looked like an uncomfortable position to be in, not how anyone would choose to sleep. Katie knew this, but she knelt in the grass anyway, reached out for the girl's shoulder as if she might wake her. Then she saw the rope and the knots. Thin rope, like clothesline. Three lengths of it on either side, knotted under the girl's armpits and at her elbows and wrists. The rope secured her to a long wooden pole that lay underneath her. It held her arms, outspread. Katie felt her own heart beating. It occurred to her that she should be afraid. It should be beating faster. But she was still taking things in, the black ribbon tied loosely around the girl's throat, the girl's hands open, palms up, blades of grass between the slender fingers. The white blouse was untucked from the skirt, and its three lowest buttons were undone. Katie could see the girl's pale stomach in the moonlight. There was something written there, in red, but not in blood. The lines were too crisp and smooth. They looked like they were drawn with a marker. They formed a single word. Mercury, spelled with a K. Neat red letters on the girl's flawless skin. Katie found herself wanting to touch them. Before her fingers made contact, she stopped herself, let her hand hover in the air. The water of the stream flowed beside her. The branches of the oak hissed softly in the wind. The noise of the crickets faded. She heard a rustling behind her, something moving through the grass and the old leaves that littered the ground. It didn't sound like footsteps, not at first. The rustling stopped, and she knew someone was there. She heard him take in a slow breath, then she heard his voice. "Don't turn around," he said. 2. 18 years later. It's not a shack, the place where she is living. If it were in a more desirable location, you might get away with calling it a bungalow. It's a one-story house, a sitting room, a kitchen, a bedroom, a bath. It's at the end of a long gravel driveway that connects it to an unpaved road in rural Ohio. The front steps are broken concrete, and the vinyl siding is blistered along the south wall where it gets the most sun. The white paint on the trim is cracked and peeling. There's a leak in the roof, so you could be forgiven for calling it a shack. Kate Summerlin steps out the front door in the early afternoon, locks up out of habit, and walks down the driveway to the road. It's warm, but the sky is gray. 2 miles east, there's a farm with a barn and a stable and a fenced-in paddock. She makes it there in half an hour. Sometimes there are horses in the paddock, but not today. She turns around at the fence and walks back at an easy pace, and when she reaches the house, she has company. There's a blue Ford Explorer in the driveway and a familiar figure sitting on her front steps. A black woman in her early 50s, tall and slender with braided hair. Police Chief Vera Landon from Alexander, New York. "You've traveled a long way," Kate says. Landon gets up on her feet, moving with a casual grace. "I tried calling you," she says. She called more than once. Kate deleted the messages. "It wasn't easy finding you," Landon says. "No one knew where you'd gone, not even your father." "That's the way I wanted it." "Eventually I went to Lee Tenick," Landon says. "He suggested I look for you here." Kate frowns. "I don't talk to Lee Tenick." "No." "I definitely don't confide in Lee Tenick." "You don't have to," Landon says, "as long as other people do." She gestures toward the house. "You've been doing some work. You went into town for supplies." By town, she means Bradnor, Ohio. A single stoplight on Main Street and half a dozen storefronts. One of them is an Ace Hardware. As a matter of fact, Kate hasn't done any work yet, but she intends to fix the roof. She bought shingles and roofing nails and a sheet of plywood. Chief Landon is still talking. "Someone saw you in town and recognized you," she says. "They told somebody who told somebody else, and eventually it got to Tenick. You know how it goes." Kate knows Lee Tenick has ways of finding things out. "Once I knew the town, it wasn't hard to find your address," Landon says. "I started asking around at restaurants. You had a pizza delivered last week." The woman shrugs as if to say, "And here we are." She's been drawing things out, putting off the subject she has come here to talk about, but now she gets to the point. "He's done it again," she says. "Mercury. You must have seen the news." Kate saw it. Of course she did. "The victim was male," Landon says. "That's unusual for Mercury, but not unheard of. His name is Brian Cahill. He was a student at Seagate College." "I know," Kate says. She has read these details online, and she knows why they're significant. The very first victim, the girl Kate found by the stream under the oak tree, was a student from Seagate, too. Mercury has never gone back to that area until now. Landon presses on. Brian was found near water, a pond this time. The night he was killed, the moon was full. Or just about. Not that there's any pattern there. Mercury has never let himself be limited by the phases of the moon. Kate crosses her arms and gives Landon a meaningful look. "We're going to talk about the moon?" she says. "Is that why you came all this way?" "No." "You must not have anything," Kate says. "If you had something, you wouldn't need to talk to me." Landon shifts her weight from one foot to the other. "I talk to you either way, Kate. You're the only witness we have." It's strange hearing Landon say her name. Kate can't imagine calling her Vera, even though they've known each other for almost 2 decades, ever since the night Kate found the body of Mercury's first victim. Kate uncrosses her arms, tries to relax. "You know, I didn't see him," she says. Landon shrugs. "You heard his voice, you were in his presence, and you're alive." "I don't have anything new to tell you. I never do." "I have to ask anyway. What did he say to you?" "You know what he said. Remind me." Kate sighs. "He told me not to turn around." "His exact words?" "Quote, don't turn around," unquote. "And what did you say to him?"
"Nothing. I froze."
"Did he have an accent?"
"I heard him utter 3 words.
"I understand that. When I was 11.
I understand that, too.
He had no accent that I can recall."
"And you never got a look at him?"
Landon says. "Not even out of the corner of your eye?"
"No."
"You've said he held a gun on you."
"Yes."
"How do you know if you didn't see it?"
"We've been over all of this many times."
"Then one more won't hurt."
"How did you know he had a gun?"
"I felt the muzzle against the back of my head."
"You sure it was a muzzle?"
"Maybe it was a toothbrush."
Landon lets that pass.
"Why didn't he shoot you?"
"I have no idea."
"Could he have known you?"
"Well, I don't know how you expect me to answer that question."
"What sort of mood was he in?"
"Are you serious?
Was he angry, calm, nervous?"
Kate puts on a thoughtful expression. "When he held a gun to my head, I kind of thought he might be angry."
Landon smiles, but her heart isn't in it. "I need something to work with, please."
"How old would you say he was?"
"I don't know."
"Take a guess."
"In his 20s.
"What are you basing that on?"
"Nothing at all."
"What was your impression of him? What sort of vibe did he give off?"
"Did you really just say vibe?"
"What did he smell like?"
Vera Landon had asked her hundreds of questions over the years, but never that one. Kate tries to take it seriously, tries to remember, but nothing comes to her.
"I'm sorry," she says.
Landon looks at the ground and nods.
"And when he took the gun away from your head, what did you think?"
"I thought he had stepped back and he was going to shoot me." Another nod.
"How long was it before you realized he had walked away?"
"I don't know. It seemed like a long time, but maybe it was only a minute."
"You didn't turn around even then?"
"No."
"You didn't catch a glimpse of him, even from the back, from a distance?"
"I didn't look for him. I ran home and told my father what had happened." Landon nods one more time, resigned but undefeated. Kate knows what's coming next.
"All right," Landon says. "Let's try it again. This time we'll start from when you climbed out your bedroom window."
In the evening, after Landon has gone, it starts to rain. Kate is in the sitting room in an overstuffed armchair, her feet propped up on packets of shingles. There's a footlocker by the chair, and on it an untouched bowl of soup. It came out of a can, and it's cold now, and she wasn't hungry to begin with. Her box of roofing nails sits beside the bowl. The plywood she bought is leaning against a wall. She'll need a dry day to work on the roof, and there haven't been any lately. She looks up at the ceiling. There's no water coming through here. The leak is in the bedroom. She can hear a steady drip into the tin bucket on the floor at the foot of the bed. The wind picks up outside and rattles the window sashes.
Kate rises from the chair and crosses to a small bookcase. She wants something to read. The shelves are stuffed with paperbacks. Robert Cray, Karen Slaughter, Ann Rule, Michael Connelly, Joe McGinnis. She spots two hardcovers with black spines and her name on them in red. They have three-word titles. The First Secret and The Absent Daughter. They're true crime accounts, each about a murdered woman. That's Kate's brand. She opens one of them to the title page and reads the inscription, "To Uncle Jim, with all good wishes." It makes her cringe a little. She was just starting out then and never knew what to write. Her Uncle Jim, James Rafferty, is her mother's brother. He lives in a suburb of Toledo and sells commercial real estate. This house belongs to him. It's been in the Rafferty family for generations, and in years past, Uncle Jim used it as a hunting cabin. These days, he would rather play golf. He's letting Kate stay here. She told him she wanted someplace remote to write. The truth is, she had 5 chapters of a new manuscript when she came here, and she hasn't added a word. She closes the book she's holding and returns it to the shelf. Grabs a copy of Fallen by Karen Slaughter. Kate has read it before, but it's worth diving into again. It works for a while, distracts her as the rain comes down. But after 40 pages, her mind begins to wander. She catches herself reading the same paragraph for the 3rd time. She tosses the book onto the footlocker. Her cell phone rings. It's in the kitchen, charging. She lets it ring. It stops eventually, only to start again. She can guess who it is. Her literary agent has been leaving voicemails every few days. By the time Kate reaches the kitchen, the ringing has gone silent, but after a few seconds it resumes. She unplugs the phone from the charger. "Hello, Audrey. You sound tired. Did I wake you?" "No. What time is it there?" "I'm in Ohio, Audrey." "I know. It's the same time zone as Manhattan." "Are you sure? Sounds like you're on the moon. How's your beau?" "I can never remember his name." "Devin." "Ah, of course. How is he?" "He's not my beau anymore." "Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that. I truly am." Audrey pauses for a beat and then asks, "How's the book?" There it is, the real reason for the call. "It's coming along," Kate says. A writer's lie. "How far, though? Would you say you're committed?" "Committed?" There's another pause and a hint of hesitation in Audrey's voice. "The reason I ask, and I hate to do this to you, but I think you might want to change course. The chapters you sent me are great, more than great. I love them. Love, love, love." "Audrey, but I've sent them around to a few people, and the news is mixed." Kate leans against the kitchen counter. "I asked you not to send them." "I use my judgment, darling. That's why you have me. The sales of your last book were soft." "I know. Not terrible, but soft," Audrey says. "The trend is in the wrong direction, so I needed to gauge people's interest in the new one. Don't get me wrong. They like it. They want to see the finished manuscript, but nobody's offering a contract at this point." "That's fine with me." "It's not, though. You want to have a contract in place and an advance, trust me. That's why I thought we might want to change course, especially given the news." "You've heard the news?" Kate closes her eyes. "I've heard it. This latest killing," Audrey says. "Brian Cahill, it's awful." "Look, just don't..." "I'm sorry. I know how you feel about these things. But I have to say, as tragic as it is, it's an opportunity for you. Because it's Mercury. You never wanted to write about the girl you found, the first victim, and I respected your decision. But now you should reconsider. You could write about both of them." "I don't want to do that." "Listen, you could tie them together. They both happen in the same town. You've got a personal connection to the story. There would be interest, no question. I could get you in advance, probably more than I got you for the last book." "I don't care about the money." There's quiet on the line for a few seconds, followed by Audrey's voice, again calm and patient. "Then it's good you've got me. I'll be the heartless one. I'll care about the money. But you should write the book. I think you know it, deep down. You could do something with it, something great. You could..." Kate doesn't hear the rest. She thumbs the red button to end the call and drops the phone on the counter. When it rings again, she silences it. The rain has tapered off, but there's still a steady drip coming from the bedroom. Closer at hand, there's a sink full of dirty dishes. Kate collects her soup bowl from the sitting room and adds it to the pile. She should clean up now, but she doesn't have the spirit for it. Outside, it's dark. The sun went down an hour ago. Kate opens the back door of the house and stands in the doorway, staring across the yard into the gloom of the woods. Audrey is right about one thing. Someone needs to start caring about money. Kate knows the balance in her bank account, knows it's getting smaller every week. There's nothing coming in. That's one of the reasons she came here. She let the lease expire on her apartment in Columbus, sold some things and put the rest into storage. But even that won't be enough. Though her expenses are lower now, she still has some. She's been playing with the idea of staying here. Her uncle has told her the house is hers for as long as she wants it. She could get a job in town. There was a help wanted sign at the hardware store. She could go ahead with a plan to fix the roof. She's never fixed one before, but how hard could it be? She leans against the door jamb and feels like crying. She knows it's no good. Yesterday she might have believed that she had a future here, that she could find not happiness, but maybe contentment. But now, after Chief Landon's visit, things have changed. The house already feels different, even though Landon never set foot inside. She's gone, but an echo of her stayed behind. It's not even her. It's what she brought with her. Mercury. Kate doesn't remember what he smelled like, but he's here, in the smell of the rain and the wet grass. She's never going to escape him. There's no point in trying, no point in staying here. Kate steps back into the kitchen, closes the door, and turns the deadbolt. She makes sure the front door is locked, and the windows, too. All she brought with her was a couple of suitcases in the footlocker. She fills them up so she'll be ready to leave in the morning. She brushes her teeth and climbs into bed. She's too cold without the blanket and too warm with it. She throws it aside. Switches off the bedside lamp, but the dark unnerves her. It didn't before. She gets up and turns on the bathroom light and leaves the door open a few inches. She can't hear the rain on the roof anymore, and there's only an occasional drop from the ceiling, a hollow plop in the tin bucket. Kate's last thoughts before she drifts off to sleep are of Vera Landon, her endless questions, the same ones over and over, as if she expects Kate's answers to change. Landon may not be getting anywhere with the Mercury investigation, but she's not stupid. There's a keen intelligence behind her eyes. Kate wonders if the woman ever suspects the truth, that for all these years, Kate has been lying to her. 3. The sky is the key, every time. Lee Tenick is not a professional photographer, but he has a good eye. He knows that a clear sky is no blessing when you're shooting landscapes. You want clouds, but not a solid mass of them. It's better if they're small, with bits of blue sky in between, or long and feathery like strands of cotton. You want them to have texture and depth, so there's something to see when the light hits them. Tenick can't complain today. The sun is starting to go down. He gets the red oak where he wants it in his frame, not centered, a bit to the left. There's a dark blue sky behind the tree and darker blue clouds, and as you move down toward the horizon, there's a touch of orange. He'll boost the colors later. Editing is what makes the difference between good and great. In the foreground, there's yellow crime scene tape strung between wooden stakes that have been driven into the ground. This is where Brian Cahill's body was discovered. The tape is twisted in a way Tenick doesn't like. He steps out from behind his tripod and tries to adjust it so it hangs the way he wants. It's stubborn. Ultimately, he has to pull up one of the stakes and move it about 6 inches. Then it's perfect. He clicks the shutter a dozen times, altering his framing in subtle ways between each shot. Then he picks up the tripod and moves it back so he can take in both the tree and the pond nearby. There's a wedge of a cloud like a battleship over the pond, with a fleet of smaller ones trailing behind it. And all of them are mirrored in the water below. Sometimes it comes down to luck. If he had gotten here 20 minutes later, he would have missed this. Click. He stays until the last of the orange is gone from the sky. Gets everything he could want. Then he stows his equipment and drives back into town to pick up something to eat. It's a village, technically. Alexander, New York, southeast of Syracuse, northeast of Binghamton. Population around 4,000, plus 2,500 students at Seagate College. Route 12B runs through the middle of it, with a crosshatch of streets on either side. Downtown is modest, but there's an inn and a bookstore and maybe a dozen other businesses. One of the standouts is a restored movie theater from the 1930s. Tenek used to have an apartment above a drugstore, but he gave it up. Now he lives in Alexander for only about 6 months of the year. The rest of the time he travels. He's got an old Winnebago, and he drives it wherever it suits him. Along the way, he stops in towns where people have gone missing, on back roads where bodies have been found, anywhere a famous crime has taken place. And famous is a flexible term. Some of the locations he visits are familiar only to a select few. True crime junkies. But those are his people. They're the ones who follow his Instagram account and read his blog. He started out posting pictures of old crime scenes. Then he added photos of law enforcement officers, witnesses, relatives of the dead. He wrote about cold cases and interviewed some of the people involved. Eventually, he bought some microphones and recording equipment, and now he puts out a podcast episode every week. Mercury is an obsession of his. At the time of the first killing, Tenek was a senior at Seagate College and a reporter for the student newspaper. He had a friend who worked as a dispatcher for the Alexander Police Department, and the friend tipped him off when the cops rolled out on a homicide one night near the end of the spring semester. When he drove out to Bird River Road, there was nothing to see but a trio of patrol cars parked at the roadside. One of the officers told him to move along. So Tenek moved along, half a mile down the road. There he left his car behind and walked back under the cover of the woods until he heard voices and saw the lights that the police chief had set up while she waited for the medical examiner. The ME hadn't yet arrived. The chief, Vera Landon, was standing at a distance from the body of the victim. Landon was dressed in khaki trousers and a flannel shirt and military-style boots, her hair in two braids pinned up to make a crown at the back of her head. Tenek kept well away from the lights. He leaned against a tree 20 yards from the scene and opened his bag. Found his zoom lens and twisted it onto the body of his camera. He was grateful for the steady chirp of the crickets. He figured the noise would cover whatever small sounds he made. He zoomed in on the body. The angle wasn't perfect, but the girl's face was turned toward him. He thought he recognized her from one of his classes, Melissa something. Melissa Cornell? The light was good enough. He could have taken a shot, but he had some measure of decency. He zoomed back a bit until he had both the police chief and the body in the frame. Then he pressed the shutter. The chief moved then, and Tenek thought she had heard him. But she crossed in front of the body and walked a dozen feet to where two people waited. One of them was a child, a girl with a blanket draped over her shoulders like a cloak. A man stood beside her holding her hand, probably her father. Chief Landon crouched down so she would be at the girl's level. They had a conversation Tenek couldn't hear. He took a shot of the trio together, but it wasn't the best. The chief had her back to the camera and was blocking part of the girl's face. He got a better shot later when the chief stepped away. That was when the ME arrived and the girl and her father were left on their own. Tenek got some photos of the two of them, the father looking concerned, putting his arm around the girl, pulling her close. One of the last shots Tenek took was a close-up of the girl, locks of curly hair framing her face, staring off at nothing in particular. This was the photograph that would in time spread everywhere on the internet. Katie Summerlin, the girl who found the body, and met the killer. It was the shot that would make Lee Tenek's reputation. There's only one place in Alexander where you can get decent Chinese food, and it's on Main Street across from the police station. Tenek phones in his order and waits by the curb in his car. Traffic is sparse at this hour, but some people are out enjoying the mild October evening. There are students making their way to a bar called Ptolemy's. They walk in.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?